Hello everyone, Lachlan Peters here. Welcome back to another special bonus episode of the show, and we've got an absolutely huge guest. Today I'm speaking with award-winning journalist and writer Elizabeth Becker. Now, since recording the interview about a week ago, I've come down with a little something. Apologies for the slight croak in my voice. I did release the episode yesterday with this intro done, but listening back, it sounds pretty bad. I'm a little better today and I'll re-record this for you now. So, Elizabeth started covering the war in Cambodia in 1973, and she has a kind of legendary status when it comes to Cambodia and the Khmer Rouge. She's written for the Washington Post, the New York Times, and is the author of When the War Was Over, a history of the Khmer Rouge Revolution, as well as a few other books on the subject. There's the Khmer language Bopana, as well as a newer release, You Don't Belong Here, which is a deep dive into the often forgotten story of the women who covered the Vietnam War. If you're familiar with the history of the Khmer Rouge, it's very likely that you will have come across Elizabeth Becker's writing. She's an expert on the subject, and she testified as an expert witness at the Khmer Rouge tribunals in 2015. Her books are great, and I would urge you to pick them up if you haven't already. So we cover the reasons that she decided to write her latest book, her experience in Cambodia covering the war, what it was like seeing the effects of the American bombing campaign, and yes, of course, the sort of reason that the interview took place, the subject of a new film by Riti Pan, her infamous tour of revolutionary Cambodia in 1978 that ended with an interview with Pol Pot, as well as the sudden tragedy that occurred the same night. So it was a lot to cover, and she was very generous with her time. Also, if you're one of those people that prefer to watch interviews rather than just listen to them, you can become a member of the Patreon. There you'll get this discussion in full, as well as a few other bits of exclusive subscriber stuff. It costs as little as $2 a month, and of course you can cancel anytime. But either way, whether you listen or watch the interview, I hope you get as much out of this conversation as I did. So here is Elizabeth Becker. Okay, I'm here with Elizabeth Becker. Elizabeth, thank you so much for being on the show.
It's very nice to be here.
Okay, so I will have given the listener a bit of a biography of you, your work as a journalist, your coverage of the Cambodian Civil War, subsequently of Democratic Kampuchea, some of your books, When the War Was Over, Bopana. But I thought we could start this conversation, and we're going to try and cover a lot of things by beginning with your latest book, You Don't Belong Here, How Three Women Rewrote the Story of War. And we're going to try and get a kind of chronological step through your story as well here. So, Elizabeth, I'm wondering if you could start us off with that book and perhaps give us an introduction to the two journalists and one photographer that are the main subject of the book, as well as you yourself and how you are present in that story and how you found yourself in Cambodia.
Well, thank you. I wrote that book because after the war ended in 1975, and in 2015, you know, decades later, I was testifying at the Khmer Rouge Tribunal. I was an expert witness there for what the court called a week, but was more like 3 days. And I was called by the prosecution, and needlessly, the defense didn't have much to defend. How do you defend the top Khmer Rouge leaders? So as like in any Law and Order episode, they went after my credibility. The only way they did that was by quoting a snotty review that said, I didn't have the qualifications to write that book because I was only a journalist. And this was a review by David Chandler, an Australian who's considered, if not the best, one of the best historians of Cambodia and the Khmer Rouge. Now, My response was simply, I had my book with me when the war was over, and I simply read the reviews, which I have to say, I was very happy. We're all great. But the defense didn't let up on me. And so I said, this was the one time he used that criteria. Subsequently, he has given blurbs or good reviews of just about every attempt by a journalist to write a book about Cambodia and the Khmer Rouge. I said there was one difference between me and the countless other books. They were written by men, and I was the only woman. Now, the defense attorney happened to be a French woman, a woman of color, and she said, thank you for the clarification, and sat down. This is 2015, and I realized if anything was ever going to slap me across the face and say it's time to write the story of women, it was this. And that was the final push. Of course, it crossed my mind, and there have been a couple of other attempts, but nothing like what needed to be written. So that's what did it. And I subsequently wrote an op-ed for the New York Times that then led to my book contract and then my book.
Amazing. And do you want to just give us a brief sort of introduction to the
There are
women
three
at
women, journalists. One, and I chose them in I think sort of a obvious way, although people were confused by it. I wanted the women who excelled in the three basic areas of journalists, particularly wartime, and that was a photographer, and I chose Catherine Loire. Well, I'll back up a bit. And once I decided to do it by category, it was very easy because it was quite clear who excelled in all three categories. So it was a French journalist photographer named Catherine Loire, who eventually w became the first woman to win a Robert Capa Award. And then for short form, I chose an Australian, Kate Webb, who was so revered that after she died, there's now a Kate Webb Prize, and for the best Asian journalists. And then I chose for long form Frances Fitzgerald, who wrote what is still considered one of the best books on the war, Fire in the Lake. All three were originals. Their work, all three were the first to break through the barriers. And so I had to explain the barriers before I could explain why they were so amazing. So they came early in the war, 66. And the war starts, the American war starts in 65. At that stage, the United States and nearly all Western Australian armies forbid women journalists to be on the battlefield. And they had since before World War II forbid it. Now, no journalist ever writes that in their war memorial. No men ever mentioned that. They just had women sort of blah, blah, but they were forbidden. Secondly, women at that stage were not allowed to be staff reporters in most journalist endeavors the United States, in Europe, in Australia. If they were, they were women's page reporters or at bottom of the totem pole in another section, but they were to they the number of foreign correspondents that were sent by journalist organizations were you could count on one hand, and they were older, and they were women who had to break through, and they're usually writing opinion. So all women, almost to a person, came to Vietnam without a job, without a place to stay, and usually without much money. And that's all three of them, except for Frances Fitzgerald, who was inherited wealth. But women just weren't considered capable. All three of them had told that when they got there, that there would be nothing for them, that women didn't belong there, hence the title. And as I said, all three broke through and not only did well, but changed the way the war was seen. Catherine Leroy did the closest to the most human and humane photography in conflict of any other photographer. She's belatedly recognized for this. And Kate, very much along the same lines, broke through the wire service problem of, and then this and then that. She humanized the whole war. And she, like Frances Fitzgerald, concentrated as much on the Vietnamese as on the Americans. Frances Fitzgerald really broke out and said, I want to write about the way this war is affecting Vietnam and the Vietnamese, not just the Americans. I don't want to do a bang bang. And she wrote stories that her colleagues thought were irrelevant. She wrote about the slums in Saigon that were filled with people who were forced out of their farms. She wrote about the hospitals where the Vietnamese casualties went, and they were this side of a butchery shop. She wrote exactly how this war was not helping Vietnamese, but was turning them into complete antagonists who hated war and were certainly at best afraid of the Americans. So they were writing stories that were not necessarily welcome. How did they get away with this? How, if they were forbidden to be on the battlefield, how did they get away with this? Pretty soon, the men reporters were noticed. What are with women doing this? Well, the American war was never declared by President Johnson. When he sent the Marines in 1965, he did not declare it. And so for the male reporters, you know, the 99.9% of the reporters there, this was great because it meant they didn't have to be part of a particular unit or be embedded or anything like that, or be censored. They were able just with their press card, they could go around the country as long as the commander said yes. So jump on a helicopter, drive over to a unit, get on an APC, whatever. And so it was open field. It was the most open war before or since. The loophole that nobody noticed was that women went there too. And they were getting away with it until 1967, when General William Westmoreland, in charge of all of the American military in South Vietnam, happened to go to inspect a unit from Hawaii Army. And there he saw someone he knew, a young woman named Denby Fawcett. And he said, Denby, what are you doing here? And she said, well, you know, I'm covering this for the Honolulu paper. And he said, how long have you been here? And she said, I think about, it's been three nights or something like that. And he said, great. Now he knew Denby because his wife played tennis with her mother back in Honolulu. He went back, General Westmoreland went back to Saigon and said, what is going on? There's a woman covering this war in the battlefield and spending the night. This is against the rules. And he was informed, we have not declared war. That can't be the rule. And to mollify him, a compromise was reached where the women signed a piece of paper, a document of some sort, saying they would not ask for any extra help because they were women. Well, they never did anyhow. And this little incident, which hadn't been reported in any book, broke all of that precedent. And from then on, that was the bridge between women not covering any of the wars before to women finally going and covering wars afterwards. And that's what happened. So it's the three great women, but also the persistence and courage of all the women who broke the rules, stood by their colleagues, and made sure that Vietnam would be the bridge that opened up conflict. Because if you're going to cover stories and be a journalist, one of the most important stories is conflict.
It's an absolutely fascinating book. I learned so much from it, and there's so much that we've just sort of gone over there that I want to pick out and talk about. But one aspect of it that you didn't mention was that you yourself sort of what maybe just a little over half a decade after sort of Fitzgerald and Leroy. Yeah, so you sort of find yourself in Cambodia as well. I'm wondering, just for the listeners who may not know as well.
I was in graduate school at the University of Washington in Seattle. And my undergraduate degree was South Asian Studies, and that was my master's I was working on. And like more than a few women, I found myself in a pickle when my thesis advisor wanted to have an affair with me. And I said, no, he rejected my thesis. So this is 1972. There's not much protection, to put it mildly, and he was tenured. So I figured I could waste my time and feel even worse fighting him, or I could file a complaint, take my scholarship money and buy a one-way ticket to Cambodia and become a journalist. And I chose Cambodia, one, because I studied it, but two, because I had a friend who I met when I was a student in India, and she had dropped her graduate studies to become a journalist, and she was in Phnom Penh at that time, and she'd been trying to get me to come and join her. So I said, okay, that's what I'll do. And that's how I became a reporter. And to tie this into the three women, she's the friend of Kate Webb. And so Kate Webb met me in Hong Kong and on my way to Phnom Penh to ensure that I got on the right plane. And then, during the next few years of the war, she was an important point for me, important person. So in a way, my book was to say thank you.
Yeah, so it's a thank you. It's a personal book as well. It showcases this groundbreaking, important work. But as you say, it's not just, oh, and this is the work of some women who happen to be journalists. This is groundbreaking work that changed how the war was seen, regardless, like their gender incidental to that. I'm wondering, you mentioned Kate Webb there, and as an Australian, you know, we've got her on a stamp now. It's it was great to read about her and her fascinating, often quite dark periods of her life as well. I'm wondering, because you knew her and then you had this experience of sort of writing about her later, is there anything that you uncovered in your research where you just thought, wow, I had no idea about that?
Well, the toll it took on her was whispered, but until I did all the research, I couldn't believe how bad it was. She was a gifted artist, which I didn't know, and she could have become a real artist if she hadn't had all sorts of different problems. But one thing was that she, when she was a teenager, 15, returning from a wonderful sojourn in Europe with her family, she got into one of those adolescent funks with her best buddy. And during that, they got more depressed and depressed and finally decided that they would do a suicide together. Kate stole the weapon from her father, a hunting gun, and they went out to kill themselves. And her friend did it first, and on seeing her friend kill herself, Kate flipped, went back, told her parents. She at first was charged with something like manslaughter, went on trial. Her dad, who was a very influential professor and personality, I believe I remember correctly, fainted on the stand. Eventually the charges were dropped, but until literally all her life, until her deathbed, that death was part of her personality. And as you know, she became an alcoholic, she became an alcoholic who could get her job done, but couldn't have a real life. And then the men were horrible. I mean, this was an era when women were not accepted as colleagues in the battlefield, much less as romantic partners who should be treated as an equal. And Kate had really bad taste in men and never found a partnership. But I guess what the one shock, the big shock was She covered her tracks so well, but at the end of the war in 1975, and this was, and I don't call it the Cambodia Civil War, that I call it the Cambodia Campaign of the American Vietnam War. And that's, to me, historically much more correct. It grew into that, but that's like calling the war in Vietnam simply the Vietnam Civil War, which was not. Anyway, 75, she is a hero. And her United Press International, which is the wire service she worked for, appointed her to the Bureau Chief of Singapore, which is a great job. And she was barely there before her top boss in Asia came to visit and demanded to have an affair with her. And she said, no, that's not part of my job description. He then reported that she was abrasive and non-cooperative, just generally as a reporter, and she would be called back to New York. Instead, she quit and she stopped being a journalist for 10 years. I mean, it's a huge wound. And fortunately, she went back and she did even better work afterwards. But so that was a shock to me. And her sister, who's still in Australia, in Sydney, was very helpful. She and her brother, too, who goes back and forth from France to Australia, they were very helpful. And all of the women's friends and families, they were very honest. Nobody tried to hide anything. Nobody.
So I'm wondering if we can sort of center it back to the time period and sort of keep going through this chronologically. But prior, you mentioned, obviously, the title of the book, You Don't Belong Here. It's something that comes up, as you mentioned. It was in all different walks of life, really. I kept imagining it in my mind as almost as if it could have been painted on the side of buildings, like no women allowed. And as you mentioned, sort of the Australian forces had a blanket policy of no women even remotely close to the combat areas. But there's something I sort of I'm hoping that you might be able to react to and perhaps explain to me. And it might, given what we just talked about, it might be handy if I just read out a short quote from your book. And you said, "Some days I was filled with resolve and excitement that I was reporting the story and giving voice to Cambodians. Other days I was near suicidal with the enormity of the destruction and feelings of loss that I couldn't describe. I stopped believing reporters who said they could push their emotions aside." End quote. And on the next page, as you were mentioning before, we have this description, self-described by Kate, as that she was getting paralytic drunk, which is a phrase that my mum and dad would say. Like I hadn't sort of seen that phrase in a while, but it's certainly a sort of generational phrase. Yeah. And it gets the point across. But I guess what came to mind while I was reading the book was where the line was sort of between two P words, paternalism and patriarchy. So where do you think there was, given the trauma, given the danger, the real life-threatening danger, the exposure to the horrors of war, where do you think the line was for some of these systems and these men in these positions to say, well, we're more protecting you from this line of work, or like this paternal instinct, or do you think it was more just this status quo, distrust of women, things like that? Or do you think it was a case by case kind of thing?
Oh no, it's just total status quo. There was not big thought about it. It was just, no, women just don't belong. It's just period blank. No. It showed itself in extraordinary things that, and this is the big shock of my research, Catherine Leroy, the French journalist, photographer. She arrives from Paris. She doesn't even have a college degree. She was a wonderfully wild teenager who played piano so well. She could have been a professional pianist. She loved jazz. She took parachute jumping lessons. in, you know, in the days when women didn't do that. And she arrived with a little camera on a string, and said, "I'm going to be a photojournalist." And one of the heroes of the book was the guy who was in charge of photography for Associated Press, Horst Voss. He said, no, you can do some social stuff around Saigon, but you're not going to go in the field. And she's, oh, yes, I have I'm a parachutist. And he didn't believe her. She was actually telling the truth. But he said, okay, my vow to myself had been, I'll buy any photograph that's good. But when he made that vow, he was thinking of opening the field up to Vietnamese photographers, male Vietnamese. He was not thinking of women. And so she goes out with this open mind, with this huge curiosity, and with her emotions and her brain all together. And she lives in the field. The soldiers love her. She takes great photographs. And within a few months, the male reporters were rebelling against her. The French sort of head of the head of the French reporters, who was the bureau chief for Agence France-Presse, coordinated with the spokesmen for the American military to take away her credentials. And that would be take away her credentials, and she has no more jobs. So they had to make up why you do it. And the list, she was following the rules. So she had to they made up a new one. One, she used foul language. Two, she smelled when she came back from the field. Three, she was pushy and made sure she got on the helicopter when others wanted to do. And four, because she was not ladylike. The first three, every single man did. And the fourth thing and they got away with it. She got a letter saying, we are from the official American, military, we're taking away your credentials. Well, she went to Horst Voss, he wrote a letter, and she was able to stay. But I got that information through a Freedom of Information Act request. I could find no other example of journalists treating another journalist that way. She'd done nothing wrong. And it hurt. I mean, most of the French reporters she wouldn't work with, most of the Americans, and there were just few that she trusted because they treated her so badly. And the better she did, the worse they were to her. They made, you know, they talked about how she was, they did what we call now slut shaming. They slept around as much as they wanted, whether they were married or not. But boy, if anything that any time she Catherine had a liaison, that was all over the place, and they made fun of her. So that was the most obvious, and that is simply across the board no women. And Frankie got it in a different way, no women. And it's just there, don't overthink it. It was simply the way it was, period. That's it.
Okay, well,
but to go back to the quote you read of mine, and this is where I think, because we had been raised as women, there's no way we were not. This was back in the, you know, we were all born in the 40s. We were raised differently. So we did not have that male, you know, don't show your emotions. And I think that was to our benefit because we integrated it all. We didn't divide up our emotions from our brains, from our talents, our skills. We integrated it. I didn't put that in because, you know, it's so non-scientific, but I think it's obvious when you read the book. The women wrote very emotional things that you can't find in any, I looked at all the male memoirs of Vietnam. It doesn't even come close. It doesn't come close. They showed their vulnerabilities. They talked about how they got around it, and their feelings for the Vietnamese informed their work. And you could see that the men, it was irregular. Oh, you know, this poor peasant unnamed, the poor farmer unnamed, the poor widow unnamed. This was much more than token. They concentrated on the bang bang. So that's very much the way I felt that I, you know, if you kept your emotions out, then I think you were robbing yourself.
Another one that stuck out to me was one of Kate's poems. Was it War? War was it, I think it was called War Groupie. And I just thought, well, this is amazing. Yeah, this is, and particularly just in light of her sort of, I imagined her in growing up in Australia as this arts, like this sort of alternative kind of person that then goes and does all this amazing stuff in Vietnam. It sounded like a lot of people I kind of felt like I knew growing up as well. And she really brought that kind of almost like that Aussie larrikin kind of spirit to it as well. I was going to read them out, but I'll spare everyone the accent. But there's a great bit where you just quote the, and we won't spoil the story too much, but at one point Kate does spend some time, let's say, behind enemy lines and is thought dead. And the Australian papers, upon finding out that she was alive, I was going to read some of those out, but I'll just get people to read the book themselves. Okay, so moving just a little bit, I guess, sort of what we're talking about here, which this is a dangerous war in Cambodia. A dreadful number of journalists being killed, many captured by the Khmer Rouge and simply disappearing. And in this part of the book, you're also talking about almost like an intoxicating, I believe you say, almost like the importance of the work that you were doing was so compelling. But there is this danger, this almost ever-present real danger, and specifically to the profession as well. So I wondered if there was a way where we could talk about that, as well as maybe just, I think a lot of listeners to the show and a lot of people interested in Cambodian history now are really fascinated with this period prior to the revolutionary period, because there's almost like this dividing line, and so few people will ever be able to experience it. I was wondering, since I've got you here, if you wouldn't mind just talking about what it was like living in Phnom Penh in, you know, 1973, 1974, the dangers of your work and the compelling nature of it as well.
Well, the compelling nature is universal. And you doesn't name the war and you'll get the same response that you, and people are more open about it now than they were in our day. You it's so hard to leave. You're so people in distress, a society falling apart, and they look to you. They looked always to journalists, and that whether it's a local journalist, the visiting journalist, the foreign journalist, you have a role that is unbelievable. Now, you're not a doctor, and some journalists feel bad because they feel like we're not very useful. But so that's, I think, and we women felt it a lot because we didn't have a backup. We were there as almost all of us as freelancers. So it was our home. We were not, I wasn't visiting Cambodia. I lived there. And that's what a lot of us did. We lived there. And we couldn't just, you know, call up and say, I need to break. Can you give me a vacation in Hawaii? No. So that was part of it. But Cambodia is a beautiful, beautiful country, that famously beautiful, that was the oasis of neutrality from independence in 55 until 1970. And one of the things I worked very hard on in my book is that I give you the history. You don't have to, I do not take it for granted that you know the history. So if you read my book, you learn the history. It's not force-fed, but you understand, as things go, who's responsible for it, what the American role was, what the Chinese role, without. So you understand that Prince Norodom Sihanouk, who was the prime minister, went out of his way and made a lot of iffy deals with all kinds of countries to keep neutral. He did not build up a big army. He made deals with the Chinese, with Hanoi, with Saigon. And he was doing pretty well, but the United States from the beginning did not believe in neutrality. You were either for us or against us. And you could see that all over the Pentagon Papers, which end, you know, at the end of Johnson's administration, but it continued on. And the United States openly supported anybody who wanted to overthrow Sihanouk and put Cambodia on the side of South Vietnam. This was an open secret. So in 1970, there was what we call a coup d'etat, but it was a little more complicated. But there were the young people, a lot of the young people wanted a change of government because they were sick of Sihanouk. He'd been the leader since the 40s and enough of Sihanouk, and they thought they would get a democracy. Then you had the military who was looking forward to, American money coming in. And then you had the royals who were sick of Sihanouk, and then the commercial class, because they wanted to be more like Bangkok with the high rises and the skyscrapers and filling up all the klongs with cement and all the stuff that Sihanouk hated, that made him look more like the West and left. He wanted to stay Asian. So all the stuff that romantically you imagine is good, Cambodians were getting sick of it. So a lot of things were coming together. Plus, they were surrounded by war. To the West, Thailand was the base for all the bombers, for some of the bombers. South Vietnam, North Vietnam, Laos. They were surrounded. All their borders, people were in that war. So it's amazing Sihanouk lasted as long as he did. So the coup d'etat happened, and Sihanouk went and took refuge in China, in Beijing, joined the Khmer Rouge, mistake number 46. And that not only gave him status, kept his status, but it meant that the farmers, the rural people who had very different views of their life than the people in the cities, automatically were sympathetic to Sihanouk. And the American war rammed into Cambodia. By the time I got there, there are barbed wires around the city, and life was becoming a little disjointed, but it was still beautiful Phnom Penh. Famously, a place that all the reporters wanted to go to because it was like a Graham Greene novel still. It hadn't been Americanized like Saigon, and certainly not like Bangkok. The very Francophile, very, very Francophile. English wasn't spoken. It was all French. And the Cambodian people are extraordinary. I mean, they're lovely, lovely people. So yes, and then you're covering the war. I arrived and they said, too bad, the January peace accords were signed. You're not gonna have anything to cover, which is totally wrong. And I was there and one of the first to write about the saturation bombing that happened because Cambodia was not covered by the peace accords. And then as the country fell apart, and it was heartbreaking. And you're there, you live there. As I said, that was my life. And I watched reporters come and go, and I watched friends die, and I didn't watch them die, but And then finally, towards the end of 74, I'd already written a piece. It turned out to be the only piece written identifying the head of the Khmer Rouge as Solat Sar, which is the real name of Pol Pot.
I found that very, sorry to interrupt, but when I saw that in the book, I found that because it was based mostly on regrets for the Khmer Sol, this Ith Thadin's, again, a hugely important, this is behind into a mystery that no one had known until that point. But I was surprised, like I was going to ask you specifically on that, because you mentioned, as you said, Pol Pot as Salot Sar.
Yeah.
But as...
And no one followed up.
When he does come out, everyone's like, oh, I didn't know that. And it's like, oh, but...
Because they didn't want to know. This is the frustration. Every journalist will have a story like this, but this is an important one. And it was Itzarin, and he was a teacher. He was in the education department. He went behind the lines because he saw that the Lan Lao regime was so corrupt and was bound to lose. He wanted to see what the other side was like. And that horrified him. He came back and wrote Regrets of the Khmer Soul. And if you lived in the city, you saw everybody reading this book with the map of Cambodia divided into a broken heart. And I mean, I think the first time I saw it was when the pedicab driver who was peddling him around, and he was waiting for me, and he had the book. And then I noticed it everywhere. And so we had it translated, another colleague. And then you put things together. Sihanouk told journalists, don't go behind the Khmer Rouge lines. I can't promise you will come back alive. Now, no other communist group said that. You know, the reason Kate Webb lived through her captivity was because she was captured by the North Vietnamese, not the Khmer Rouge. And she writes that the North Vietnamese said, no, you don't want to go near the Khmer Rouge. So there are tons of clues here. And then also the other thing was that they were openly antagonistic towards their North Vietnamese allies. So no, you're wrong, Elizabeth. And people told me, you know, you're falling for black propaganda. And U.S. embassy was divided. Some of them thought, well, that's ahead, that's good. And others said, no, that's, you know. So, and it was never followed up. So then everybody said, oh, we didn't know. It's because you didn't follow it up.
Yeah, I was like, but how did this
and
come
Sihanouk
out?
Yeah. And you can blame Sihanouk for that. Sihanouk, yeah. I'm the leader. No, or he would say stuff like, "Oh, I'm like the pit in the cherry. When they win, they'll spit me out." But who's they? I mean, you know,
and yeah, we had a penchant for the dramatic.
Yeah. Anyway, so there you are.
Well, I didn't want to interrupt you too much there, but I guess so we're sort of approaching 74. As you also mentioned there that you're covering the bombing campaign in 73. I did want to, this is another one where, like, this phrase, American bombs, American bombing, this is now the norm for more than 50 years, is the impact and the imagery and the meaning of this phrase, American bombing. But very few people have actually seen what this looks like when it hits the ground. And again, as I have this opportunity to ask you, I wonder if you could just describe for listeners, what is it like to see the actual effect of American bombing?
It's, first of all, it's like you go down the road and everything's normal, and then you see that town, that field was hit. And you think in your own life, well, I could be going down West Seattle and all of a sudden there it is at the Alki Beach. You know, it's like, it's not, you have your imagination of battlefield and regular life. No, this is regular life. And it's haphazard. Who's ever seen trees that look like black stumps and water buffalo upside down and houses? There's the bombs, and then there's the explosions, and there's the chemicals, and it's haphazard. It's and then you interview the people fleeing. They don't know what they've experienced. This is they're almost sort of a medieval kind of understanding of the world. They barely understood what an airplane was, and they called it almost universally the fire from the sky. Where did the fire come from? And did it come from a god, from Garuda, which, you know, the great bird, and also the name now of Indonesian Airlines. But this is a destruction of life that you have to see to believe. And you never become inured to it, not at all. And it's always different. You can see the photographs, but you can't smell anything. You can't feel the heat. You can't feel the smells of smell the heat, the atmosphere. It's desolation. It's the definition of desolation. And it's, and then you follow the people back to find refuge, and they go to Phnom Penh and they flood the city, and there's not enough food, and you follow it up and you find them in the camps, and it's, there's no way to take care of them. They're lost. And but you know, it's your, it's another American up in the airplane, and they don't know what they've done. And pilots, in fact, one of the lawsuits to stop the bombing was instituted by American pilots who didn't want to do it anymore. They were reading what we were writing, and they did not want to take part in it anymore. I mean, at any time I hear the phrase targeted bombing or anything pretending that this, there's a target, no, they have no idea. No. It's still, I mean, to this day, you still see shells. And then that doesn't count all of the other residue of the fighting that still is buried in the soil in Cambodia. But Laos to the north is the most bombed country per person in the world. Cambodia's in the top five. Vietnam, of course, is too. So it's like Indochina was Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos during the American War was the most bombed, I believe, in history. And so we were watching it, and we didn't know. I mean, I was trying really hard not to exaggerate, because thinking I'm naive, this is my first war. But then when the figures came out in 90, President Bill Clinton's second term, he released a lot of the records, including the bombing, and we were pretty much right. It was that much saturation bombing. And it was much worse. People, when they think Cambodia bombing, they think of the illegal bombing in 69 before the war was declared. But that was nothing compared to what we witnessed in 73. And it ended in August 15th, 1973, because Congress, which then was had a lot more spine than it does now, Congress demanded it. The administration, the Supreme Court was also moving in that direction. So then, and President Nixon was under fire for Watergate. So he finally let go in August of 73.
Wow. It's incredible to hear your perspective on that. And briefly, could you also describe, you must have been reading the reports coming out just prior to and during the fall of Phnom Penh, as well as the immediate aftermath in April 75. What was that like as someone who had such a connection to not only the reporting itself, but also the people there and the country itself?
Well, the shock was the immediate evacuation. That scared me. Why were they doing that? And I couldn't, you know, the report said, okay, that was the shock. And in the process of that, of course, the foreigners who remained went and found refuge in the French embassy, but all of the Cambodians were sent outside. So that's when the Cambodian journalists, including Dit Pran, who was a very good friend, was not allowed to leave. So that was heartbreaking. And then the evacuation was not temporary, as they said it would be. It was permanent. They had said they had done it to avoid being attacked by the United States, more bombing, which of course wasn't going to happen. So that was peculiar. And then it became permanent. And then they sealed off the country completely. It's North Korea is an open liberal country compared to what these guys did. Borders all sealed, no telephone, no telegram. And of course this is, you know, 75, so there's no internet, no way to compute. You could send letters, but it would never go in. You'd never get a response. No way. The first year, Cambodians were able, some were able to flee across to Thailand, but after that, the border was really sealed. And so I would read the refugee reports, but I was reluctant to I was asked if I wanted to write anything, and I didn't want to write anything because I didn't know what was going on. And I read in those days, the United States had a very good service where the Foreign Broadcast Information Service, where you could read a translation of what the official radio was saying. And I read that, and it was, you know, it was dull, horrible commie talk, but you could get an idea of what they thought they were doing. And then you'd read what the refugees were saying on the Thai border and what the Hong Kong gurus were saying, but it didn't make sense. So I used to stay after work and write letters to the Cambodian embassy in Beijing to ask to get a visa. And whenever the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Ying Seri, came to the UN, the only time any Cambodian came to the US, I would make sure to get up there and go to either a press conference or reception any way I could see him and say, please let me come in and be a reporter. So I did one story when he gave Ying Seri gave a press conference on their version of the Mayaguez incident. And other than that, I was torn. And I did, you know, some people said, a lot of people, that some experts went and testified that don't jump to conclusions. Refugees often don't tell the truth. And some went and bought and turned their refugee stories into insanity. And one entire book was called Murder of a Gentle Land, which said the reason they were so cruel was because Khieu Samphan was homosexual. I mean, it was crazy. So I didn't do much in terms, I didn't write. I read as much as I could, but I didn't write. And then, as you know, in December of 1978, I got a visa.
Yeah, that neatly brings us to that point. But I just wanted to ask, just in that period of uncertainty, so you've got, as you mentioned, you've got refugee reports coming out, you've got naysayers, you've got the Ponchaud book.
That's very late. Ponchaud is late.
Yes, it's 78, I think.
So I'm talking 75, 76.
So early days still. But by the time, as you say, you're lobbying Ying Seri to come in, and there is this, broadly speaking, left and right, I guess if that's a easy enough way to put it, these perspectives on, you know, the question mark that was democratic Kampuchea, and is it, are millions of people being killed, or is it all just, it's just a standard revolution, nothing to see here? You've got friendly delegation, like Communist Party delegations from the West, Australia, US, that have their little visits and come back with glowing reports. So I guess by the time that you're packing your bags in very late in 78, it was December, if I'm not mistaken. So December 78, did you have an inkling either way? And I guess that sort of leads to my question. Like, is this the core reason that you wanted to go? You just had to find out for yourself what's actually happening there. Was that like the best case scenario in your mind? Like, I'm actually going to find out for myself.
Well, there's no myself separate from my journalism. I owed it in a sense to, as a journalist, to Cambodia. I mean, I can't not do it. I can't not want to do it. I mean, you follow the story, and a story that you put so much into anyhow, but also because it was terribly important. I mean, as I said, I'd written in 74 that Solat Tsar and the Khmer Rouge were on the side of cruelty. I mean, and I wrote exactly how. So at the same time, when the refugees said they killed anybody who wore glasses, that's at best symbolic. Then there's just the basic, why do you cut off your country? I mean, that's a number one, you know, what are they hiding? And then there was all the testimony that was at the Geneva, the UN's Human Rights Conference in Geneva, and they had lots of stuff, and it was scary. So yes, yeah, scary. Yes, you had, you know, delegations. They all saw the same things. So, yeah, I had all the briefings you're supposed to have here in Washington, and then I went to the border, and then caught the plane in Beijing. Then called Peking. That's how long ago it was. I did not know what I was going to do, but I was hoping I could see someone from Phnom Penh who could tell me something. And they got sick of me asking for that. But anyway, go ahead.
I was just going to say, in when the war was over, you describe it as a twilight zone version yep. of Cambodia. And again, just like that pre-revolutionary period that I think a lot of people are interested in including myself, this is, you know, a very rarefied air to stand in democratic Cambodia, to walk through the streets of revolutionary Phnom Penh. I would just love you to help explain to the listeners and myself, like, a sense of what it was like generally. How did it function? What did it look like? What did it smell like? And in the book, you described this, when I was reading it, very, what's the phrase here? Bold move, maybe, to, is it maybe on the first or second day you're there, you basically sneak out of your lodgings and go and try both and days. Find your own room at the hotel. Yeah, the Phnom. Yeah, so I was wondering if you could jump off from there, maybe.
Well, it didn't feel bold because it was my city, right? But it was also because all the delegations, there was no problem with any of the other delegations. So why would there be a problem with ours? I mean, I was not expecting problems. What did it, I think I wrote in the book, it was like, it was somebody else's dream or nightmare that I knew that the city had been evacuated in April 75, but here it was December 78 and was still empty. I did not expect that. I knew that the cathedral had been torn down. I didn't expect it to be bare. And the bank, I mean, all the places I knew, they were either empty, the streets were empty, the sidewalks were empty, the central market was empty, everything was empty. And this is a people who love to congregate, who love to dance, who love to sing. That, I mean, empty. Temples, everything is empty.
When you say it was empty as well, sorry, just to briefly ask, were things sort of boarded up as well, or was it just more or less just left and
it was less, disrepair? There wasn't so much boarding up. Mm. It was... So when they drove us down main streets, Manivong or whatever, mm. there was the tableau was not awful. It was, it looked like the streets were clean. They sometimes there would be flowers and you could see the doors and stuff, but the temples were empty. When I snuck out and I went on the other streets, that's when it was just trashed. They left it. It was trashed, trash, 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 trash. And, so when I walked up, Noerdam and Manivong were both good, and they would drive us that way. But they would watch which streets they would even drive us on because they didn't want to see the rest. So I didn't know how daring it was until they lectured me, and finally they locked our doors from the outside, so I couldn't do it anymore. That was a sign of something.
So you're mostly in the north. Part of the city near sort of what Phnom in that kind of area.
Well, we were at the old, the what was then the presidential palace area down toward if you're going to go straight over to it was on Manivong between Manivong and Noerdam.
Okay.
And but you know we were driven all over the place and we were never allowed to walk. We were always in a car. This was everything was controlled. Propaganda tour. Only went where they arranged for us to go with us, make sure we did only saw the people they had arranged, their translators, everything. So this was strict propaganda tour. And
So speaking of this propaganda tour you're on, part of it, you did actually get to see Angkor for the first time. Right. Not many people can say that they were escorted around by a Khmer Rouge cadre, but what was it like seeing these beautiful temples for the first time?
It was the one relief in the in a real relief in the thing. I knew they were not in good shape, you know, and but at the same time, it was intriguing because all through the trip, I never saw a portrait of Pol Pot or any other Khmer Rouge leader. It was the only art they showed in all of the buildings was a classic painting of Angkor Wat. That was their legitimacy, and it was bizarre. I mean, apparently they were planning to do a bust of Pol Pot later, but this was it. And so you seeing Angkor, it was wonderful. It was a relief that it was there. And even if it wasn't in good shape, that, you know, like Cambodians to the end, no matter where they're from, Angkor was protected. And the pictures, it's one time that we're all really smiling. Oh, by the way,
that's a nice one.
The University of Washington has my archives, and I'm in the process of captioning all of the photographs, so it'll be open. You can find it digitally whenever you want.
Oh, beautiful. Well, you've just mentioned Mr. Pol Pot as well, and it's sort of now the subject of a recently released film. And now I realize you must have been asked this question 1,000 times, but I must ask it as well.
What was Pol Pot like?
I looked at different ways of asking it, but and your description in the book is really fantastic. But for the listeners out there, you sat down for an interview, which turned a bit more into a 2-hour diatribe or lecture. But what was it like meeting Pol Pot?
Well, they set it all up, and he was sitting in the beautiful former Governor General Palace right on the river. He was sitting down. He never rose. We walked through the long foyer into the hall, and I didn't realize how many preconceptions I had until I saw him and realized I was surprised at how charming he looked, handsome, well-groomed. You know, not like a guy who had just come back from being, you know, beating up on people, whatever, or, you know, whatever. He was very, very comme il faut. He was just the way you're supposed to be, in beautiful Mao suit, and very charming, great smile. We sat down to orange juice always, and a little bit of a chatter, and then they announced that the questions we had sent in on our first day would be answered in writing. And then we got to hear his lecture for 2 hours on why Vietnam is at fault and will invade Cambodia, and why he expected NATO troops to support him. Then in a nutshell, but
the NATO bombshell must have been surreal to hear.
And he thought that the Warsaw Pact, the Soviet Pact, would be supporting Vietnam, and these two, NATO and Warsaw Pact, would be fighting over Mekong, over the rice fields. It's crazy.
It sort of brings up something that I was going to talk about before, and maybe we can still briefly discuss it. Is this, you know, he's talking about NATO troops coming into Cambodia with this upcoming conflict with Vietnam. And you've been shown, you know, a Potemkin village style of Cambodia. You've seen, you know, peasants happily working in the distance, and all these photo opportunities. You've been to, I'm not sure if they said it was like a high school or a tertiary education center where they're going to, you know, you've got barely, you know, illiterate children that are going to be fast-tracked into, you know, fourth-year French engineers in no time. It's this sense of unreality that, you know, these are educated people. These are the leaders of a nation. You mentioned in the book this mixture of lies, fear, belief in what they were saying. But I wonder how, you know, given that you wrote a history of the regime. And how much do you think that this unreality figured into the entire project of democratic Kampuchea?
I think that the leaders in the 60s who were the intellectuals, who I won't go into all the names, but there were intellectuals who had very smart ideas, who would have been more Deng Xiaoping kind of leaders. They were still alive and eventually were killed because they did not square with Pol Pot and number two, Nguyen Chia. And that it became, the more they failed, the more crazy they became. And you can see it, that they will never go back and say, well, maybe we should have not done that. Maybe we should have left some doctors alive so they could take care of the people. Maybe we should have left some accountants alive so we could really, they never, never learned from any of their mistakes. Instead, they punished people for the mistakes, and they punished people, killed, punished meaning killing, torturing and killing people who said, this is crazy. I mean, so the top intellectuals who could have been a positive force were all killed. I quote from a Chinese diplomat who I couldn't name, who was friends with one of them, Kuai Tun, and he went back to Beijing after he realized that Kuai Tun had been murdered, and that was it. They were out of control. So how much of, I mean, I'm not going to say, I can't get into their heads, but I can see what they wrote, and Qu San Pons, all their thesis and everything they said beforehand did not look like that. So
amazing.
That's all I can say for sure. But and then the record shows that they went out of their way not to learn their lessons and to blame the messenger and then to get rid of any naysayers.
Well, that brings us, we've got very little time left, but Elizabeth, I wanted to ask you if however briefly or however much detail you wanted to go into, just to clarify for listeners, I mean, you've sat down with Pol Pot for 2 hours, your bags are packed, you're ready to leave the country the next day. Do you mind just briefly going into, for those that don't know, what actually happened at the end of your trip?
Yeah, we were three. Two American journalists, myself and Richard Dudman, who was much my senior. I was 31 and he was 62. So he was the elder, much more experienced, but not in Cambodia, reporter. And then the third was an academic, a history lecturer named Malcolm Caldwell, Scottish, teaching at School of Oriental and African Studies, an activist, anti-war, strong, open, supporter of Pol Pot. So two journalists, one strong supporter. And he was very charming, but he and I did not agree. And I write in the book of all the problems I had. And Dudman was more on his side because, quotes, we didn't have any proof of torture. Well, of course we didn't anyway. So, but we were very happy at the end. We all had a good time. We had dinner together. We went to bed. And about, I think it was after midnight, I woke up to the sound of what I thought was garbage cans falling over. But then I smelled cordite and I realized gunshot. And I went out into the hall. I was on the ground floor and ran into an assassin. And we were in a government guest house. There should be no way that assassin could get in. I ran, screamed in my best kamar, no, don't. And I ran and hid in my bathroom. And he went upstairs, he threatened me with his gun. Then he went upstairs, threatened Dudman, and to get him back into the room, shot at the bottom of his door. And then he went in, broke down, pushed through the door of Malcolm Caldwell and killed him, right, cold blood. And all I knew was that I heard all these shots. Then I heard someone running down the stairs. Then I heard silence. I don't know, a couple hours. Then I heard a body being dragged up and down. Then I heard a door crash, more silence. Then soldier came in, followed by our guide, Prasit, who said that Dedman was safe and Malcolm Caldwell had been murdered, and they blamed the Vietnamese. I said, but no, I saw him, he's Cambodian. They said, no, he was Vietnamese. So I don't, that obviously didn't sleep. I was, the terror is unbelievable because I was in this country where no telephones. Who was I going to call? Even if there was one, there's no way. I mean, I was it. That was it. And so then I said, so was this the beginning of the Vietnamese invasion? And they said, no, you're the only house that was attacked. Again, we were the last diplomatic group. Why? Anyway, so I sent all through the trip, I was sending telegrams that never arrived. And so we got on the plane that morning with Malcolm's coffin. There's a ceremony at the house where Yang Suri and Prasit and other people were around, and they did sort of some non-religious sort of ceremony. And Prasit went with us on the plane to Beijing. When we got there, nothing was prepared. They had refused to send any of the telegrams. So we had, the Americans had finally opened up a mission, not a full embassy. And they were contacted, and I stayed with them and wrote my stories. And the wonderful reporter in Hong Kong for Washington Post at first didn't believe what I wrote. And he checked, he said, is there anything on the wires? This doesn't make any sense. And so, and then by the time I left the next day, there were reporters at the airport to meet us. But it was horrible. It was just horrible.
And after all these years, I just wanted to ask that, these documents came out afterwards where, they're writing reports of during the whole trip, Becker confirmed obvious CIA agent, things like that. And perhaps this is what you were going to say, but after all these years, do you have a sense of what happened that night and the meaning of it, if there was a sort of objective?
I haven't changed my opinion that that this was a dispute within the top ranks, that I'm not sure how you would divide it up, but someone didn't want any more foreigners to come. Someone wanted a message sent out to the world. And you choose the two Americans, two journalists, and you killed, why it meant you had to kill Malcolm, I don't know, but it was, I went and I flew to London afterwards to meet his widow, and I couldn't, all I could do was tell her what happened. I could not tell her why. And the only thing I can say is that, why did they kill all the others? It was just as irrational. Why would they be more rational with us than the others? That's the only thing I can say.
It's an incredible end. It's almost like this incredible footnote to what is, the almost 4 years of their regime, and it ends what a week or so afterwards. It's almost surreal. And thank you so much for sharing that with me. But I realize we're really pushing it up against the timing here. So we haven't spoken too much about Ritty Pan's new film, Meeting with Pol Pot. And I just wondered if you would briefly, just a brief message about how that collaboration was, and then we'll call it.
Well, this is the second movie he's based on something in my book, When the War Was Over. The first one was about a woman named Opana. And that's from my book, and it's in Khmer language. And unless you have been to Cambodia, I doubt that you've seen it. This one he's wanted to make forever, and it's about those 2 weeks. He fictionalized it. And, I trust him. I said, sure. And he cast an absolutely spectacular actress as me, but it's my character, it's not me. We're no longer Anglophones, were three French people, and I'm a French radio reporter. Richard Dudman, the 61-year-old white American, is now this gorgeous black photographer. And Malcolm Caldwell is now this French intellectual who went to Sorbonne with Pol Pot, which of course Pol Pot never went to Sorbonne. But Richie, he's a gorgeous, gorgeous, smart, feeling, and quirky, great, great, great director. So the truth is there, and he has Irène, the actress who plays me. Her name is Lise, not Elizabeth. And she does almost everything I did, but it's a wonderful film because Richie shows what's really going on the other side. So that's why. I did not know. None of us saw the film until we went to the Cannes Film Festival, and we saw it all together, Richie and me and the actors and all of us. And he was worried that I wouldn't like it because he fictionalized it so much, but it was so true. The truth was so there that I was just totally moved. It was wonderful. It was just, he gave our trip the importance, and it was fraught. It was important and emotionally draining, and he made it, and the actors were superb. So yes, if it ever comes to Australia, I don't know. It hasn't come to the US yet, so I don't know when it's going to get to Australia.
Yeah, I keep Googling it just to see. Hopefully soon it'll get that video on demand release. But Elizabeth, thank
that's
you.
That's a good way to end.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yes. Everyone, keep a lookout for this movie. As you said, it probably will get a wider release soon. Elizabeth Becker, an absolute honor. Everyone, if you haven't ever read When the War Was Over, one of the best books on the history of Cambodia and the Khmer Rouge, and her newest book, You Don't Belong Here, an amazing exploration into pioneering journalism during the Vietnam War. An absolute pleasure, Elizabeth.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.